You're listening to a podcast recording of The Nature of Things. This podcast was initially recorded May 27th, 2005.
My wife has a reputation as an extraordinarily compassionate woman, but there is one thing about which she is passionately uncompassionate: mice. In or about the house, or any place else in which we have an interest. I suspect that most of you out there would be of like mind, and I'll have to admit I've had some annoying episodes with mice, including whitefoot and meadow varieties. Still, in the nature of things, the thought that the only good mouse is a dead mouse gains new meaning. In nature, a dead mouse has a high probability of becoming a meal for some predator or scavenger. Creatures which have much higher profile and perhaps acceptance in our lives than mice. I learned this early in life in my perusal of great nature art. Audubon, Leiforce, and Fiortes were not reluctant to portray this natural process. Fortunately for me, although my elementary teachers thought me too young and fragile-hearted to be aware of the blood in nature, my parents and principal mentors didn't. I probably didn't connect this evidence of tooth and talon with the essential energy flow of nature at that early age, but by the time it was pointed out to me, my inner sensibilities were ready to receive it and process it. The contribution which the much-maligned rodent clan make to the flow of energy, which results in such magnificent endpoints as golden eagle, goshawk, mountain lion, and bobcat, is enormous. I want to get it clear that anyone who grew up on a farm couldn't escape the destructiveness of meadow vole, whitefoot, and our imported rodents to the economic interests of man. That, too, is enormous, and it certainly colored my attitude toward those we contended with on the farm. Even there, however, my farmer brother considered carefully how any controls he employed would affect the food chain. On the farm, dead is the best state for the vole. But there is also the knowledge that a dead field mouse is as much a beginning as it is an end. At any rate, the eyes of nature are blind to those human value judgments. In nature, every creature has a self-ingrained motivation to survive, but that doesn't really conflict with the fact that its broader role is a function of its untimely death by the teeth or talons of its principal dependent. It's probably an outrageously vacuous thought, but if a field mouse had to file an income tax form, I would allow it to list the family of great horned owls I knew as partial dependents. When I lived on what was then called Snake Swamp Road, about 2 miles from the Oswego campus and about a half mile from Snake Swamp itself, I discovered a small hemlock grove at the edge of the swamp where great horned owls nested and digested. Scattered over the ground were the coughed-up pellets, which contained the indigestible remains of their meals. I collected a small pail of them and made their analysis the subject of a biology lab in which my students, mostly elementary education majors, disassembled and analyzed the contents of owl pellets. To avoid major grossing out of my mostly female students, I pointed out that these were not scats or feces, but were indigestible remains that couldn't be allowed to accumulate in the stomach. The students soon became engrossed in the project. Their findings revealed that the owls had subsisted mostly on moles, shrews, meadow voles, deer mice, muskrats, and cottontails. Less than 5% of the contents of these pellets consisted of birds. Although ruff grouse nested within a stone's throw of the owl's nest, grouse remains occurred in only one pellet. There were two conclusions my students made as a result of these studies. Great horned owls are highly beneficial neighbors, and rodents provided the main sustenance of these great horned owls. In terms of value clarification, this presents a kind of dilemma. I left them to struggle with that, secure in the fact that both owls and rodents had gained a point or two in their esteem. Perhaps, too, they might be less prone in the future to base their environmental judgments on social evaluations. Today, if I were still teaching, I would be stressing the disconnect between environmental health and economic prosperity. Many economists have maintained that the standards proposed for environmental quality are too expensive. Some even doubt the need for them. If the relationship between mice and sound environmental policy seems obscure, I'll just say values clarification for now and enlarge on it later. Don't hold your breath. You may very well not agree with my premises. Well, that's all I have for today. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week and keep it natural.